Before I begin, I would like to thank the organizers for the opportunity of giving this talk and of telling you about some research that Mike Stillman, my advisor, who's over there, Damiano Testa, who's now in Italy and was visiting Cornell for a year, and myself have been working on for the past few months. So the title of the talk is The Homogeneous Coordinate Rings of Some Del Pezzo Surfaces, and it's going to be divided in four parts roughly as follows. I'm going to begin with the background that is going to take probably a significant amount of the talk, around half an hour, which I'm going to define the terms in the title. What are homogeneous coordinate rings? What do I mean by some Del Pezzo surfaces? And then the whole thing together. What are the homogeneous coordinate rings of Del Pezzo surfaces? Then there will be one slide with the questions that have guided our research over these 8 months. Then a significant period of time with the answers to those questions. And at the end, if time permits, I want to present an open problem that's purely combinatorial nature that we have not been able to solve. So let's begin. The idea of homogeneous coordinate rings was introduced by David Cox in an attempt to generalize to arbitrary toric varieties the relationship between the ring of polynomials in n plus 1 variables and projective space Pn. This attempt was very successful, and Cox managed to show that for every toric variety T, there is a multigraded polynomial ring S which has the relationship with the toric variety that we see between the ring of polynomials and Pn. Namely, first, we can recover the toric variety from S and the choice of an irrelevant ideal, much in the same way in which from An we get Pn once we remove 0. And second, there is a correspondence between graded modules over S and sheaves on T, which, as in the case of Pn, is not one-to-one, but he also studied to which extent this correspondence fails to be one-to-one. So when these results have received a lot of attention in recent years, and I guess that one of the possible directions is to try to answer to which more general projective algebraic varieties can these types of rings be extended. And this is where the idea of Cox rings come in. Cox rings were introduced by Yi Hu and Sean Keel in their paper Mori Dream Spaces as a way to extend this idea to more general algebraic varieties. Their definition is roughly as follows. To construct the Cox ring, this is very important, we basically, for each divisor in the Picard group of the surface, we construct the sheaf associated to the divisor, and then we compute its space of global sections. If our variety is projective, this is going to be just some finite dimensional vector space. And then we take the sum over all the D's in the Picard group, and this gives us this huge vector space to which they show it is possible to assign a multiplication that transforms it into a graded ring. I won't discuss the details of this multiplication, but well, at least not for general algebraic varieties, but later I will say something about how it works for Del Pezzo surfaces. Well, Del Pezzo surfaces are among this class of more general algebraic varieties for which you can define a Cox ring. And what I'm going to do now is talk a little bit about what Del Pezzo surfaces are. So, definition. A Del Pezzo surface XR is the smooth surface obtained by blowing up P2 at R points in general position, where I'm allowing R to vary between 1 and 6. I guess two words of warning are worth making about this definition, which is, first, that this is not the definition of Del Pezzo surface. I am using a more restricted version. Normally, I would be able to allow also 7 and 8 points, but during this talk, when I say Del Pezzo surface, it will always mean at most 6. And second, one has to take into account the automorphism group of P2. So if one takes 4 general points in P2, it's always possible to bring them to the standard coordinate. So because of that, there is essentially one way to blow up at most 4 points. And so when I say a Del Pezzo surface X4, I might as well say the Del Pezzo surface X4 because there is only one. For 5 and 6 points, the situation changes dramatically and we have infinitely many essentially distinct Del Pezzo surfaces. So that will be important for us. Now, every Del Pezzo surface XR can be embedded in projective space by the linear system corresponding to its anticanonical divisor. And this is important for us because this is maybe the most natural way to think of Del Pezzo surfaces. In fact, maybe the most famous example of them are the cubic surfaces in P3, which is what you obtain by embedding X6 by this anticanonical linear system. So we all know some del Tesla surfaces take a random cubic polynomial in P3 and take its zero set. That's a del Tesla surface. The advantage of our description as a blow-up is that we can get a very clear description of some very fine invariants of the surface. First, we know what the Picard group of the surface is. So the Picard group of XR is Z to the R plus 1, and the description as a blow-up also gives us a natural choice of basis. So our basis will be given by the first component. It's going to be the pullback under the blow-up map of the class of a line in P2, and we're going to call that L. And the remaining R components are going to be the exceptional divisors of the blow-ups. As an example, just for concreteness, the canonical divisor in X4 is the canonical divisor in P2 minus 3L plus the sum of the exceptional divisors. And we can write that as a vector. So this is something very concrete, very, very simple. Now, the advantage of fixing a basis is that in terms of this basis, we can give a simple description of the intersection form on the surface. So what's the intersection form? The intersection form is essentially the right version of Bézout's theorem for the del Tesla surface. In which sense? Well, the intersection form is a function that takes a pair of divisors and produces a number for you. It turns out that if these divisors correspond to the divisor classes of curves, that number is precisely the number of points of intersection of the pair of curves. So this is why it's called the intersection form, and this is how we will use it. Now, I mentioned earlier that if you take a cubic surface in P3, you will get a del Tesla surface. And I guess the statement, the 27 lines on the cubic, is something that one has heard perhaps many times. And that is not something that happens only for cubic surfaces, but for all del Tesla surfaces. They have the property that they contain some very special curves, which are actually lines contained in the surface when you think of it as embedded by minus k. And so this is something that we will be very interested in, and leads to a definition. So an exceptional curve C is a curve whose class in the Picard group satisfies this pair of equations. And these equations basically encode what's written in the top of the slide. They correspond to the lines contained in the minus k embedding. Now, since we know explicitly how the intersection form on the surface works, these two equations allow us to explicitly compute what these exceptional curves are. And this is what we will do now. So this table basically classifies the exceptional curves for the del Tesla surfaces obtained by blowing up 4, 5, and 6 points. This is what the columns correspond to. So for 4 points, there will be 10 exceptional curves. For 5 points, there will be 16. And for 6 points, there will be 27, which are, again, the 27 lines on the cubic. And it's worth observing that they come in three sets, and that they are easy to visualize if the lower part of the slide you should think of as P2, and the dots correspond to the point that I'm blowing up. And, well, with this picture, they are easy to visualize what the curves are. There will be the exceptional divisors EI, which you should think of as sticking out of the picture. There will be the lines through pairs of points, or more precisely, the strict transforms of those lines under the blow-up maps. And there will be the conics through 5 of the points. And the table also contains their classes in the Picard group, which we will use in the future. So one looks at this table, and there's a very surprising fact, which is that we observe that for 5 and 6 points, there are infinitely many distinct del Tesla surfaces. And yet, the number of exceptional curves doesn't change. It's independent of the choices of the coordinates. And it turns out that something much stronger is independent, not only their number, but their configuration. And their configurations can be visualized in a very nice, very combinatorial way, which is the graph of exceptional curves. I guess I'll define it and then show you how it is. So the graph of exceptional curves is a graph whose vertices are the exceptional curves on the del Tesla surface, and I draw an edge between two curves, even only if they intersect on the surface. And when I do that, I obtain this graph. So for r equal to 4 points, you obtain the graph on the left. And for r equal to 5 points, you obtain the graph on the right. The graph on the left is the Petersen graph. And the labeling corresponds to the labeling that I had in the last slide of the exceptional curve. I did not draw the one for 6 because it will have 27 vertices and be perhaps too complicated. So the statement, which is really very surprising, is that if you take a random qubit polynomial and you look at the lines contained in its zero set, they are arranged in the form of the graph that I didn't draw. So imagine something bigger than this. And this is independent of the choice of the cubic polynomial. Now, I guess that the most striking feature of this graph is that they are surprisingly symmetric. For example, the degree of every vertex on the left is 3, and the degree of every vertex on the right is 5. So one would like to know why this happens. And it's easy to explain it. And this is where another ingredient comes in, the Weyl group. So for each value of R, there is a Weyl group WR which acts on the objects we have defined so far in two ways. And these two actions are really very important. So first, the Weyl group acts on the Picard group by automorphisms of the abelian group structure, which have the property that preserve the intersection form. That is, if you take D and E and you take their dot product, you will obtain some number. And if you take their images under any element in the Weyl group, G, and you take the dot product, you will obtain the same number. And they have the property that they fix the canonical division. So this is the first action, an action on the Picard group. And there is a second action, which is basically by permutations of the exceptional curves. And since it has the property that it preserves the intersection form, it will map two curves that intersect to two curves that intersect, and so it will act as automorphisms of the graph. And the reason that our graphs look so symmetric is really that these groups are enormous. For 6 points, the corresponding Weyl group, which is the Weyl group of the root system E6, has 51,840 elements. And it acts transitively on the exceptional curve. There are a lot of things are known about this. So I want to be a little more concrete about how this action works. Describing it for the whole Weyl group might be difficult, but there is a very easy subgroup of the Weyl group in which the action is very simple to describe, so I will. So for every R, WR contains a copy of the permutation group in R letters. And I'm going to tell you how this permutation group acts on the Picard group and on the exceptional curves. So the action on the Picard group is given as follows. Remember, this is the component corresponding to the line, and this is the component corresponding to each of the exceptional divisors. All right, so it just acts by permuting the last R components, and you know it's a permutation, so we can do that. And the second action is by permutation of indices. So as an example, let's see. How does the element 1, 2, 3, 4 act on the exceptional curves? And the easiest way to see this is in the graph. So 1, 2, 3, 4 should exchange index 1 by index 2 and index 3 by index 4. So what happens with the Petersen graph when we do that? Well, the vertex over there, F3, 4, stays. The vertex F1, 2 also doesn't change. While E3 and E4 switch, E1 and E2 switch, and, for example, F2, 3 goes to F1, 4. So what's happening is that we're really performing a rotation in this sense. And that is, it's not a rotation, it's a flip, let's say. And this is a symmetry of the graph. And what happens is that any element in the Weyl group, not only in SR, but in this big thing, keeps the adjacency. And so acts as automorphisms of those graphs. All right, so here I'm going to stop talking about del Pezzo surfaces and go back to Cox rings. So what I have done is I have defined del Pezzo surfaces. I have said what the exceptional curves on them are, and I have defined these groups which act on the Picard group and on the set of exceptional curves. And we'll need those ingredients later on. So back to Cox rings. The Cox rings of del Pezzo surfaces were studied for the first time by Viktor Vasiliev and Oleg Popov in a paper entitled The Cox rings of del Pezzo surfaces, in which they show the following surprising theorem. They prove that the Cox ring of a del Pezzo surface is a K-algebra generated by the exceptional curve. Okay? In particular, we know that every del Pezzo surface contains only finitely many exceptional curves, and so that the Cox ring is a finitely generated K-algebra. Now, if we have a finitely generated K-algebra, we are, you know, just by definition, we are able to write it as a polynomial ring modeled by some ideal. And what we would like to do is to obtain a description of the Cox ring, which is as concrete as possible. So, more precisely, if ER is the set of exceptional curves in XR, we know that the Cox ring of XR is isomorphic to K of ER mod CR, where K of ER means K adjoined with one variable for each exceptional curve, and CR is some homogeneous ideal, which we do not really know, at least in principle. And K of ER is Z to the R plus 1 graded, because the Cox ring is graded by the Picard group. And moreover, we know that CR has to be homogeneous and prime, because the Cox ring is a graded integral domain. And we expect, of course, the ideal CR to depend on the coordinates of the Blouinot points, at least if we're blowing up 5 and 6 points. Now, of course, what we would like, or what I'm going to do in the rest of the talk, is trying to describe explicit presentations of these Cox rings. And something one could ask is, well, why? Who cares about having explicit presentations of these rings? And there are basically two reasons. The first reason is that for R greater than or equal to 4, Delpetro surfaces are not toric varieties. And so we know, because of the result of Cox, that for every toric variety, the Cox ring is a polynomial ring. And what we would like to know is what happens when we go beyond toric varieties. So they are very important as examples to understand how close to the polynomial ring the algebra is. And second, algebraic geometers are very interested in these rings because they seem to provide the right way of compactifying the space of Delpetro surfaces. So results like what Brendan Hassett has done and other people point in that direction. And so there has been a lot of interest in these rings. So one would really like to describe explicit presentations. So now let's try to be as concrete as possible. Well, for R equal to 4, Cox of X4 has to be a quotient K of E4 mod C4, where K of E4 is K adjoined with one variable for each exceptional curve. So here, I'm probably not pointing. Do you guys see what do I point at when I point? Or I'm just... Oh, yeah, I might need that. A little unfortunate. All right, so... So we have 10 exceptional curves, of which the last 4 correspond to the exceptional divisors, and the first 6 correspond to the lines through pairs of points. And moreover, we want to assign to K of E4 the structure of a graded ring, where the grading, we want it to come from the Picard group. So basically, we assign to each variable its class in the Picard group as degree. And we get 1 minus 1 minus 1, 0, 0, if we start with F1, 2. And in the same manner, the degree of E1 is just 0, 1, 0, 0. So we could forget everything that I have said about the algebraic geometry and just think of this as a graded ring. And you know, it would be a strange grading, but it's certainly a very friendly, very well-known object. Now, the question that one would like to answer is, what are the relations? What should this ideal C4 be? So in general, it's hard to tell what C4 has to be, but it's easy to construct some elements inside C4. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe a way to constructing many elements there, at least the elements of degree 2. So begin by letting D be the pencil of conics through 4 points. We know that the linear system of conics through 4 points has exactly 2 global sections. And it's also easy to observe that it has 3 special sections. The 3 special sections are the ones that I have drawn here. So for example, the lines through 3, 4 times the line through 1, 2, it has degree 2 and goes through the 4 points. So it's a section of the bundle of conics through 4 points. Similarly, here and here. And I can write those in terms of monomials as F1, 2, F3, 4. It corresponds F1, 2, F3, 4. And I can do the same thing with all the other ones. And so what's the situation? What happens is that we have this two-dimensional vector space, which is the global sections of O of D. And in there, we have 3 vectors, the 3 vectors corresponding to these distinguished ones. So because of that, they must be linearly dependent, because there are too many. And one can write an equation for linear dependence, which is this. This equation is satisfied at the level of sections. So it must be a true relation in the Cox ring. As a result, the quadratic polynomial that we obtain here, A, B, and C are just constants, is an element in the ideal C4. And we could do the same procedure for every divisor whose space or global sections corresponds to is two-dimensional. And so this is what we will do now. We will basically characterize the divisors such that H0 of over XD is 2. And then in there, look for all the distinguished global sections, the reducible sections, and use those to construct relations. So definition, a conic bundle D is a divisor which satisfies these two equations in the Picard group. And in particular, its space of global sections has size 2, and any three sections in there must be linearly dependent. So since we have equations in the Picard group, we can solve them, and we observe that for 4, 5, and 6 points, the number of conic bundles that we get is 5, 10, and 27. And then the next step is how to construct the quadrics. To construct the quadrics, what we do is we basically write down the ideas generated by the linear dependencies among distinguished global sections, just like we did in the former slide. And when we do that, we get this very large idea. So for 4 points, it has 5. For 5 points, it has 20. And for 6 points, it has 81 quadrics. So although they are very large, something that is worth mentioning is that these ideals are very explicit. We have code in Macaulay that, given the coordinates of the blown-up points, will produce for you the relations coming from conic bundles, this ideal QR. And then, well, And then one would like to understand what's the relationship between QR and CR. So remember, CR is the correct ideal of the Cox ring, and QR are just these quadrics that are much simpler that we are able to construct. Much simpler, at least in principle. So explicitly, let's see what the ideal Q4 corresponds to in the case of the blow-up of P2 at 4 points. Again, K of V4 is K adjoined with the exceptional curves, with the grading coming by the Picard group. And Q4 is an ideal generated by quadrics. This first quadric is the one that we obtained in the previous slide. It's exactly the one in the example. And the remaining four come from the conic bundles of lines through each of the blown-up points. And so we have these extra four. So the first one corresponds to L minus E1, the second one corresponds to L minus E2, and so on. So this is our ideal Q4, which we can write very explicitly. In this case, the 4 points have the standard coordinate. Now, this is the slide with the questions. I'm done with the background. This is the slide with the questions and with what we have been interested in understanding. So in their paper, Batyrev and Popov proved that CR and QR are very closely related. CR is, in fact, the radical of the ideal QR. They also showed that for R equal to 4, both ideals actually agree by observing that the Cox ring of X4 is a well-known integral domain, the coordinate ring of some Grassmann. And, what we wanted to understand, once one sees these two results, they're very reasonable questions, is first, is the ideal of the Cox ring equal to this ideal generated by quadrics that we know very well in general? And actually, this statement, or the fact that this statement is true, was conjectured in their paper. This is a conjecture by Batyrev and Popov in that same paper. And second, one would like to know how much like the coordinate rings of Grassmannians are the Cox ring for higher values of R. And I will be more specific about what do I mean by how much like Grassmannians in the future. So first, I'm going to try to answer the question number one. So is CR equal to QR in general? So since we know that QR is contained in CR, there is a very obvious strategy to try to prove that the ideals coincide. Namely, prove that their Hilbert theories are the same. If we do that, then we're done. Now, in this case, this might be an interesting idea because although knowing what this ring is, the correct ideal of the Cox ring, is very hard, we can reasonably well understand what the multigraded Hilbert series corresponds to. So we know that the Cox ring as a vector space is equal to this sum. And so, the corresponding multigraded Hilbert series is going to be just sum over the divisors in the Picard group of the dimensions of this vector space. And this coefficient T to the D is simply a Laurent monomial that will tell you which divisor are you looking at. And so, although we don't know anything about this one, we can know many things about it. Given a D, it's possible, using the Riemann-Roch theorem and Kodaira vanishing, to know exactly what the coefficient of H0 of O of D is. So this is for specific divisors. For classes of divisors, it's extremely hard. So we have to do something. But still, it is something that we can get some information out of it. And actually, we can get a lot of information if we start using a little bit of the algebraic geometry of the Lippetzo surfaces. I guess this fact, which is very important, and says that for any divisor D on a Lippetzo surface, the dimension of the spatial global sections of O of D depends only on the intersection products of D with the set of exceptional curves and with the canonical divisor. In particular, since we know that the divisor groups act by preserving this intersection form and fixing the canonical divisor, we expect that, or I mean, it's easy to prove that H0 of O of D equals H0 of O of G of D for any element in the divisor group. All right? So as a result, the Hilbert series of the Coxring is invariant under the action of WR. So we know really a lot more because WR is very, very large. So once this is observed, there is a more concrete way to try to prove this equality. We know that the right side is invariant under the action of the Weyl group, and we would like to know that both sides are equal. So it suffices to first show that the left-hand side is invariant under the action of the group, and then show that the equality holds in some sufficiently large class of divisors, so that they are like a fundamental domain for the action, and then you can bring this equality everywhere else by acting on WR, acting with WR. So, well, once this has been written, it's important to ask yourself, well, why would the Hilbert series of the left-hand side be invariant under the action of the group? So, generally, when one has a ring whose Hilbert series is invariant under the action of a group, the reason is that the group itself acts by automorphisms on the ring. So we thought at first that was what would explain this phenomenon. And to do so, we define an action of WR. So let's remember that WR permutes the exceptional curves, as we did in the case of the Petersen graph. And as a result, it acts on the ring K of ER by permuting the variables. So in particular, it acts by automorphisms of the ring K of ER. And under this action, it turns out that the idea Q4 is invariant, so that these automorphisms of the ring descend to automorphisms of the Coxring and explain the invariance perfectly well. I mean, this is just a trivial result. But it turns out that for R greater than 4, the statement no longer holds. It's not possible to define an action which extends the action by permutations, even if you multiply by constants, that would lead the ideal Q5 invariant for a general choice of points. So this was quite a problem. It was very sad. And so, nevertheless, we did some computer experimentations, and we found that the following very interesting phenomenon happened. So remember, QR we know perfectly well. We have Macaulay code to write it, and so we can play with it. And we observed that the equality written here happens. That if you take an initial ideal of QR and you act on it by an element of the Weyl group, then you land in another initial ideal of Q. Just like if the elements of the Weyl group were automorphisms, but they are not. So let me write this more precisely. In general, suppose that you have an ideal I, and some weight vector, and with respect to this weight vector, we compute some initial ideal. And now suppose that you have a group G which acts by permutations of the coordinates. So the group is called W, and the element is G. And then we do the same above. And since it acts by permutations of the coordinates, the image of a monomial ideal is a monomial ideal. And it turns out this is true for every ideal and every group acting. It turns out that if you use the obvious action by permutations on the weight vectors, this ideal is obtained from this one by taking initial ideal. Now, in particular, if I is left invariant under the action of the group, these two points collapse, and we get a diagram of this form, I. And then we go to an initial ideal, and we go to another value of I, which we know that is equal to G of in WI. Okay? So basically, these two points collapse and the diagram becomes a triangle under the assumption that I is left invariant under G. And what we observed is that precisely this phenomenon happens even if our ideal is not left invariant under the action of the group. And so we were trying to explain this phenomenon. And to do so, we proposed the definition of monomiality, which is written there. And I will describe more precisely in a second. So first, let's introduce some notation. For a polynomial H, let mon of H be the set of monomials which appear with non-zero coefficients. And then we say that a group W acts monomially on an ideal C up to degree D, if for every H in C of degree smaller or equal than D, and every element in the group, there is another element H prime in C with the same non-zero monomials as G of H. So this is perhaps a confusing description, so I'm going to draw a picture. Imagine that this is your ideal C. And this is this created component, and suppose that you have a polynomial H of degree smaller than D. And then what it says is that you can take any element of the group and act on H with this element, and you will obtain a new polynomial which maybe is outside the ideal. Nevertheless, there exists another polynomial H prime, which has the property that the monomials that appear in H prime are the same monomials that appear in G of H. Okay, so if this phenomenon happens for all elements G and G in the group, then we say that W acts monomially on the ideal C up to degree D. And with this definition comes a theorem, our first result. For any integer D, there exists an open dense set of choices for the coordinates of the R of Lonov points such that the group WR acts monomially on the correct ideal of the Cox ring up to degree D. So that this property that we observe, this triangular diagram, is satisfied at least if the initial idea has degree smaller or equal than D. So instead of discussing the proof of this theorem, I'm going to give you an example to verify that this restriction, there exists an open dense set of choices, is actually necessary. That is simply not true that the action is monomial for every choice of Lonov points. So here's the example. You take P2 and you blow it up at 6 points in the way which is shown in the picture. It's perfectly possible, even if the points are in general position, that 3 lines through 2 of those points have this extra 7th point in common, which we are not blowing up. This is what's called a Delpeto surface with an Eckart point. And I will show you that for a Delpeto surface with an Eckart point, the action on C6 is not monomial. So here's why. We know that this line, and this line are linearly dependent because they have a common point in P2. So because of that, there is a relation of this form in C6. The line through 1, 2, the line through 3, 4, the line through 5, 6 must be linearly dependent, so there is some element of this form in C6. But now let's act with the element of the Weyl group, which is just permuting the points 2 and 4. When we do that, the line through 3, 4 becomes this dotted line through 2, 3. The line through 1, 2 becomes this dotted line through 1, 4, and the line through 5, 6 stays fixed. So we have passed from 3 lines that had a common point to 3 lines that did not. So in particular, they are linearly independent in P2, and the corresponding monomials satisfy no non-zero relation. And so the image under this element permuting 2 and 4 of this polynomial has no corresponding H prime. So the action is not monomial for an arbitrary choice of Lonov points. However, it is monomial for general choices. And I guess it's worth saying at least something about why is it the Weyl group and not something else. The reason is that if you take an element of the Weyl group and you act with it on the ideal of relations of a Delpeto surface, you do not land in the same ideal, but you do land in the ideal of relations of a different Delpeto surface, or better, of another presentation of the same Delpeto surface as a blow-up. And so this is why the value group should be the right object to think about. And then what happens is that if you fix D, there are only finally many ugly configurations like this one, which you can't get rid of. And in the remaining open set, the action turns out to be monotone, because it's not very hard once this example has been observed. Now, why do we like this theorem? Because it almost explains what we observed in Macaulay. We observed, so the following statement is true. If WR acts monomially on CR up to degree D, and the initial ideal of CR is generated in degree smaller or equal than D, then we see the equality that we observed. The image of an initial ideal is another initial ideal. Of course, there is still a little bit of a problem, which is we observed that this property happened for all values of D, not only for certain monomial ideals, not only for certain monomial initial ideals of a given degree. And, we can actually get rid of this restriction on the D. Basically, what we want to do is change the quantifiers, or the order of the quantifiers. The theorem that I showed is that for all D, there exists an open set such that the action is monomial in there below D. And what I would like to say is there exists an open set such that for all D, the action is monomial, because this is really this would really explain the phenomenon that we observed. And this can actually be done. One can even get estimates for what the value of D has to be by using a very nice theorem of Diane McLagan that says that anti-chains of monomial ideals are finite. I guess that if there is time, I should probably say a little bit more about it later. But, this theorem 2 basically proves what we observed. For a general choice of points P1 up to PR, the Grobner fan of this ideal of relations, of the correct ideal of the coxswain, which we still don't know what it is, has to be symmetric under the action of the group. So you should imagine this decomposition of R to, say, 27 into cones, and this has this huge symmetry group with 51,000 elements. So it's really a very beautiful object. Now, what's nice about having this monomiality theorem is that it allows us to characterize the initial ideals of CR, even if we don't really know what the ideal CR is. And this is how it goes. So the setup is that you have a monomial ideal, which is generated by a set of initial terms of CR. Okay? And you want to know whether it actually equals the initial ideal. And there is this criterion to do so. So I guess so it basically says, suppose that M is formed by a set of initial terms in the correct ideal of the coxswain. And there are two technical conditions. Basically, the degree of the generators of M are low enough, and it does not involve all the variables. Then M will be equal to the initial ideal of CR, even only if the following two conditions are satisfied. And it's important to observe that these conditions depend only on the monomial ideal. So if you had it explicitly, you could check whether or not they are satisfied. The first condition is that the multigraded Hilbert series of M is invariant under the action of the group. And the second condition is that it has the correct values along the ray which corresponds to the multiples of the class of the line. This theorem is actually quite hard to prove, basically because what you really want is to obtain a reduction of the information that you really need to compute that is as strong as possible. But it's possible to do it, and we have. So I guess that is worth saying now that given a monomial ideal M, if one wanted to check using this theorem whether or not it's an initial ideal, point 2 is trivial. It's something very easy. You just look at the generators and it immediately comes out. But point 1 might be extremely difficult. Try to verify the invariant of the Hilbert series. And I'll discuss that in a second. But now, how does this theorem, which talks only about the correct ideal of the coxswain, helps us to verify whether or not QR and CR agree? And here's how it works. Imagine for a second that M were formed of initial terms of the ideal QR. Remember that QR we know explicitly, so it's easy to get monomial ideals in here. We also know that this has to be true because QR is inside CR. And then we ask ourselves two questions. First, is the Hilbert series of the quotient of R by M or of M itself invariant under the action of the Weyl group? And second, does it have the correct value? So does it have the correct value along the multiples of the Clausewitz line? So we can check these two things explicitly from our set of generators. And if the answer in both cases is yes, this would imply that M equals the initial ideal of CR. Hence, the initial ideal of CR and the initial ideal of QR are equal, and CR and QR must be two because their Hilbert series are the same since they have a common initial ideal. So this is very nice because it allows us to prove the equality between QR and CR without ever looking at CR. I guess that since it was QR at the beginning, okay. And using this theorem, we were actually able to prove Batterier's conjecture. So for R smaller or equal than 6, the ideal CR is the ideal generated by quadrics coming from the conic bundles. In other words, CR equals to QR for R equal to 4, 5, and 6. So since the monomiality is something that we knew for a general choice of coordinates, in principle, using this argument, you can only get that the equality holds for general points. But then when you look at the generators, you can extend it to all of them. So really, the content of the statement is showing that it holds on an open density. Okay, so this is the first question that we wanted to answer. How is the Cox ring? The answer is the Cox ring is this. Cox ring of XR is the quotient of K of ER mod the ideal generated by quadrics that we can write. So we have Macaulay code to compute the Cox ring. This is, I guess, the outcome of the first part. And now we are ready to discuss question number two. How much like the coordinate rings of Grassmannians are the Cox rings of XR for values of R greater than 4? So we chose these three properties that hold for the Cox ring of X4, which is a Grassmannian, and we decided to study them and to see to which extent we could generalize them. So for time restrictions, I will not say anything about parts 2 and 3, but I will present some results about point 1. So theorem, the edge ideal M of the following graph is an initial ideal of C5 for all del Petzo surfaces X5. So what's happening is that you have this infinite family of del Petzo surfaces. Each of them leads you to a Cox ring, so you have this infinite family of Cox rings, and all of them simultaneously generate to the edge ideal that you're looking at. And so I guess that before discussing the proof of this theorem, it's worth saying what are the consequences of it. So first, if you look at the simplicial complex corresponding to the edge ideal, it's easy to see that it's shellable. One finds a shelling of the 34 tetrahedra that form it, and that's that. And then one can also show that the edge vector is symmetric. So these two statements imply that the Cox of X5 is a Gorenstein ring, essentially because shellability implies that it's Cohen-Macaulay, and then the symmetry of the edge vector gives you the functional equation that I think Stanley's theorem needs to guarantee that something is Gorenstein. And, well, the other consequence is that, you know, the graph is an edge ideal, so that there is a quadratic Grosvenor basis. And every ideal every G quadratic ring is a Kozul ring. So the second statement, Cox of X5 is a Kozul algebra, follows immediately from this initial idea. I guess it's worth mentioning that with an entirely different proof, the first statement was known to Batyrev and Popov. They actually showed that this statement is true for all values of R. So what we have is a less general, but the second statement was not known. So the proof of this theorem. So to prove this theorem, basically one follows this criterion, which I'm covering. So essentially you have the edge ideal, which here. So you have this edge ideal, and you basically want to verify on this edge ideal these two conditions. You want to check whether the Hilbert series has the right values in the multiples of the class of a line, and you want to check whether or not the Hilbert series is invariant under the action of the group. The second part is actually easy. You can even, you sit down, write it by hand. It's really an elementary thing. But then to verify the first, the situation becomes a little more complicated. And let me show you why. The problem is that this is the multigraded Hilbert series. So the multigraded Hilbert series equals a rational function, and what I've written down is that rational function. And I'm going to have to introduce some notation for this formula to make sense. So G of t, what's written in the denominator over there, is the product over the EI in the set of exceptional curves of 1 minus t to the degree of EI, which I'm just going to write as EI. And any monomial of the form y1, a1, up to y5, a5, is really the elementary symmetric function corresponding to this. So every term should have 120 representatives of t sigma 1 to a1, t sigma 5 to the a5. Okay? So this formula is huge. And the only way that we have to guarantee that the formula is invariant on the W5 is the lamest one. We basically write it down, and we have the explicit generators, and we check whether the generators change or not. And, you know, it's 5 computations. But it's, I mean, for a computer, it's no problem. But as the number of points increases, it becomes increasingly harder. So I would like to propose this first question. I would like some input from someone. How does one show that the Hilbert series is invariant without explicitly computing it? And So Alexander Young in the first class that we had last week mentioned that a formula is useful if and only if it's simpler than the problem that it tries to solve. So I am not sure if this formula is useful, but I think that it might be. Because if you think about it, the power series expansion of this huge rational function has this form. So, if you look at given a divisor D, you simply look at the coefficient, and it tells you what H0 of D is. So it's much better than Riemann-Roch. It's really an extremely explicit description of what the values of this H of D have to be for all divisors in adequate conservation. So it's really interesting. Okay, and now we were also able to prove that if a quadratic Romer basis exists, then it has to correspond to the edge ideal of some subgraph of the graph of exceptional curves. In the picture that we have, the thicker graphs, the thicker edges, correspond to this one. So this sits inside the graph of exceptional curves like this. So it's maybe not so easy to find. And another question that I would like to ask is, how does one characterize all subgraphs of the graph of exceptional curves whose Hilbert series is invariant under the action of the group? This is a purely combinatorial problem. I am sure that somebody, I think it's an interesting problem and that is perhaps solvable. And I can even give you the answer. Up to the action of W5, there are exactly 18 essentially different quadratic Romer bases, and I have a list of them. So if anyone wants to try the problem, I can give you much more information. It's about 5 points. And then the question is, what happens with 6? For 6 points, we have not been able to find a quadratic Romer basis, although we have tried really hard. And we have been able to prove that if such a Romer basis exists, it must be huge. It must involve at least 25 of the 27 variables. What I mean by involve is that on the generators of the edge ideal, at least 25 of the 27 variables have to appear. And this looks a little bit at random as a result, but it's really not. It depends on a theorem about the 27 lines on the cubic. And so this is why I wanted to include it. 27 lines on the cubic have many consequences, in particular that there is no quadratic Romer basis for C6 with 24 variables or less. So, more concretely, we do not know if for 6 points there is a quadratic Romer basis. And we do know that finding it at least to some extent exhaustively is impossible. And then, well, one wonders what happens for r greater than 6. So far I have used my false definition of the Delpeta surface, which allows you only to blow up 6 points. So now let's pass to the real definition in which you can blow up 7 or 8 points. So for 7 points, all the arguments that I gave work equally well, and we are able to prove that the correct ideal of the Cox ring is Q7. So Batterie's conjecture also holds in that case. For 8 points, the situation is much more complicated, though. So we know that Q8 is generated by more than 10,000 quadrics, and verifying the invariance of the Hilbert series of any candidate initial ideal, even if we had one, which we don't, is simply unfeasible. It's something that just cannot be done. The Hilbert series of this thing has more terms than atoms in the universe. It just cannot be done. And so, and E8 has 7 million elements, so it's really not. So it's really necessary to answer these combinatorial questions that I presented before. I mean, we need to understand why that phenomenon happens before we can say anything about 8 points. Okay, this is what I wanted to say. Thank you.